Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. It's Thursday.
Right. Well, right now it's Wednesday night.
It's Wednesday night, and you have a brand new episode of Waste Time with It's the Real, which comes out on Tuesdays.
Well, which is actually Monday night when it actually goes out.
You know what? It's a day of the week, and this is the second episode of A Waste of Time with It's the Real that you guys are getting, and it's a surprise.
Surprise to you and surprise to us, because we only decided to do this half an hour ago.
Well, why did we decide a half an hour ago?
For a few reasons, but the main reason is because Eric and I were putting together a show for Los Angeles on Thursday, November 2nd.
Right. Thursday, November 2nd in Los Angeles, California at the Bootleg Theater.
Right.
We're putting on a live show.
Right. It's a comedy show. There's music involved. We're going to have special guests. It's going to be dope.
Right. If you heard about our SOB's show here in New York, if you heard about our Highline show here in New York, if you heard about our show out in London, if you are longtime fans of ours and you know what we did at Bonnaroo or at Ganzevoort here in the city, you know that we put on an energetic, fun, dope show.
Right. Well, we don't do anything like half-assed.
We don't.
Yeah, it's full-assed. And so the thing is that we really want to sell out our LA show.
Well, explain why we want to.
Because, Eric.
Yes.
Because if we're able to sell out LA, then that funds the podcast.
Yeah, if you guys consider that this is the 142nd episode that we've done, if you guys who don't live in LA, who don't live in California, who may live in Ohio, or you may live in Florida, or you may live overseas, if you go to itsthereal.com right now and buy a ticket for $20, if you think about the math, if you've listened to all of our episodes, that's 142 of them, your $20 is about 14 cents per episode. If it's worth it to you for those 14 cents, you will help us sell out our show in Los Angeles, California. And we can then give those tickets to people who live in Los Angeles.
And who normally would not come if they were like faced with the idea of, do I really want to buy an It's the Real ticket? I'm on the fence.
Because here's what we're looking to do. And here's why London was such a great show, is because we're going to a new market. New York City, this is our biggest market. Los Angeles is not our biggest market. London was not our biggest market. But what we do is we create something that we can build off of. And our goal, as we were talking about the last couple of days, is to grow our audience. We love our audience, but we want to double our audience. And we want to triple our audience. And if you guys believe in It's the Real, if you believe in our podcast, our music, our tweets, if you've met us in person, if you guys believe in us, and look, I know we don't like to call ourselves underdogs, but what's the truth? The truth is that
we're
good
looking. Oh.
No. The truth is that we're good looking underdogs that are not attached to a big media company. We don't have a big record deal. We're not surrounded by assistants and interns and people who can do everything for us. This is a two-man operation. We want to blow this thing out. We want to be the biggest podcast in the world. We want to have our records spun all over the country. We want to do more live events.
Right.
We've proven we can do New York. We've proven we can do London. Help us prove that we can do Los Angeles, and let's grow that market out there. And you know what happens after Los Angeles?
Is that we can take this to places that are probably closer to you. So we are going to try and do something in Chicago. We want to come to Dallas. We want to come to Houston. All these places that people are saying.
Toronto and Atlanta and D.C., Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. There's like four big cities in Florida that people want us to come to. There's lots of opportunities for us to travel around the country. Let's make it worth our while. Let's build this into something.
Right. Because right now, if we can be completely honest, our agents, who are the only people who are on our team, they don't believe that we can take this anywhere but in New York.
So let's prove them wrong. Let's do this one city at a time. And so we've come to you guys, our real fans.
Right. And I do want to say, like, when we went to London, we did that by ourselves with the help of Raj and
Project Gersh
and, you know, a couple of other people who were able to actually make that happen. But we did that outside of our agents.
So what we're trying to do now with your guys' help is really level up. That's been our credo. I know you guys believe in us. Let's do this together.
And if you see it as, you know, you're just dumping $20 and maybe you're not getting anything back, you'd rather just get the podcast for free, then buy some merch. You know, we have merch for sale. It's thereal.com/shop. We're going to be working on making some more merch in the future, but, you know, we're slow in getting there.
Right. But you know what, though? We're getting better.
Yeah.
If anyone's listened to this podcast, you know it's gotten better.
Yeah.
If anyone's listened to our music, you know it's gotten better. If anyone has seen us once again, we've only gotten better looking.
I mean, can you get better looking than perfect?
So, please, guys, go to itsthereal.com, buy a $20 ticket, forward that PDF to eric@itsthereal.com and jeff@itsthereal.com. Show your support for your boys, and we will keep giving you guys the best content online. Jeff, who's on the podcast today?
Today on the podcast, we have Arsonist from the Heatmakers.
Arsonist. So, obviously, you know we've been on a hell of a streak when we're talking about, like, Rockefella and Dipset and, you know, that New York City sound. Big Face Gary and Shari Bryant and Wayno Clark and Clark Kent and Johnny Nunez and who am I forgetting?
I mean, the 10 people that we got together.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Rockefella celebration that we did at Highline Ballroom.
Yeah.
Maul from the Joe Budden podcast. And this is right in that realm. Arsonist talks about going to Howard University to be an architect.
And then?
Well, not finishing.
Yeah.
Howard University, not his call. And stumbling into music and developing a career, making beats on beats on beats, and then taking those beats and finding a happy home with the Diplomats.
Yeah, he created Diplomatic Community.
If you guys love the Diplomat sound, if you love Cam'ron and Jim Jones and Juelz Santana and Freaky Zeeky, when they were running rap, that's him. That's that sound. That's that sound that everybody from Fat Joe to Kanye West wanted.
So we met Arsonist like 2 months ago.
Right.
And he's so incredibly smart and so funny and just the perfect podcast guest.
So we were thrilled to have him up here. And some of the gems that he drops, from Nicki Minaj to Gucci to
Grandmaster Flash.
Oh my. That. Okay.
The Grandmaster Flash story is the best story.
This is a great podcast. We're happy to give you it on a Thursday. We're happy to give you it on a Tuesday. Whatever day of the week you're listening to this, we appreciate you guys. Once again, go to itsthereal.com. Buy a $20 ticket if you're feeling really great. Buy the VIP ticket. And if you live in Los Angeles, we'd love to see you there in person. Thanks, as always, guys. Jeff, when do you want to get into it?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. White Walkers, a.k.a. You're Dead Wrong.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Suffering from Success, a.k.a. Dollar Sinus Infection.
Classic. It's on you now.
Oh, what's up, man? It's your boy.
Also, this half of the Platinum Boys, the Heatmakers, man.
Yeah, and it's a waste of time with It's The Real. Boom. What's happening?
Good, man.
Yeah,
man.
Good to see you. We dropped by your studio a couple weeks ago.
I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having us, but the last person that we expected to see there...
Spraga Benz.
Was Spraga Benz.
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
Yo, he walked in and we're just like, what?
By himself, by the way. Like, no entourage, no nothing. Just, and the record we made was incredible.
Well, the music that he was playing ahead of time
sounds
dope.
Yeah, now his album sounds dope. And the crazy thing is, I think the next day, Wayne Wonder came through.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I saw that on your Instagram.
I'm putting together this hip-hop, like this Heatmakers of Reggae type of thing.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so it should be fire. And I got Egyptian coming through next week.
This is just like
Tanya Stevens. I did a record with. It's fire. It's fire. Man. It's fire. It's fire.
Well, let's get right into it. Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Mandeville, Jamaica.
Right. How big was your family?
My family's pretty big. I have not a couple. One of my uncles passed away, but I have two uncles and eight aunts.
Whoa.
So you know, from the aunts, I have a bunch of cousins and. So I have a big, and that's from my mother's side.
Yeah.
That's my mother's side. My father's side, I have two aunts and one uncle.
Wow. And Mandeville it's in the country. So yeah, like so that's
I'm specifically from Manchester, Mandeville. Manchester's the parish.
But like, were you guys like in like a compound? Was it just like everybody was there?
Well, my family?
Yeah, yeah.
No. My family, my mother and a couple of sisters were the first to move over to the States, and you know, my father was still working back in Jamaica, and my mother was out here trying to, you know, set up shop as far as, like, get a house and get a job over here. And when we first moved, we were staying with my grandmother for, like, and I probably never said this on an interview before, but that's crazy. I stayed with my grandmother for, like, about a year until we got our own place, you know what I'm saying? But I was young, so I was, like, four or five, so it's vague to me. But, you know, I remember that. But a lot of my family spread out. I got family all the way from... all the way in New York, all the way to Washington State, to I got some family in Germany, because I have some family members that's in the military and things like that. You know.
So
what I mean?
Where was your grandma staying up here?
Yeah, in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
She was in the Bronx. So that's how I ended up. That's how the Bronx was my the destination.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been any place else, but I had, my grandmother was already set up in the Bronx, so we just came to the Bronx.
What block are we talking?
We're talking Edson Avenue in the Bronx.
And then when you guys got your own place, where'd you go?
You went to Bauk Avenue, which is like driving distance of no more than 7 minutes. You know what I mean? It's the same part of the Bronx, the Northeast Bronx.
Yeah. So what's going on there around then?
Heavy crime. You know, like those were like the Larry Davis days, and the and there was a dude, I don't know if anybody from the Bronx remember. There was a dude by the name of what was his name again?
He
was
Jeff Rosenthal.
No, not I think they called him the Predator. But he was on like America's Most Wanted. He was just going around the Bronx killing people. The Bronx was dangerous around in the '80s, man. Like early '80s, it was, like I said, it was just a bunch of, that was the Rich Porter Alpo times in Harlem. So, you know, people that wanted money didn't try to make it. They just either robbed for it or they hustled for it. And the Bronx was known for robbing for it. So it was a lot of dangerous killers around the Bronx around those times.
So does that mean that your mom's like not letting you out, like
around those times? Yeah, they was my father thought that I would get robbed for anything.
Yeah,
like if I had on a jacket that might have been like $100, he's like, yo, take that off, because this gonna happen to you, that gonna happen to you. But me, I was always the type of one, I was stubborn. Two,
so if someone came up and they were like, give me those shoes, you would have said no?
Eric, they were his shoes.
Shoes. I mean, look, so like for me, at a certain point in my life, if somebody would have came to me and tried to take jewelry off of me, I would have probably put up a fight for it. You know what I mean? Now I'm at the age where it's like, I understand you can buy things back and things of that nature, but I always have a problem with people taking. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I don't know. I just look at people that steal as like the lowest form of people on this planet, man, because it's like people work hard for something and you just wake up one morning and say, I want to take it.
Yeah.
So I always had a problem with giving up things when I think about it like that. But again, like, you know, I have kids now. I'm smarter, man.
You're going to what middle school, what high school up there?
I started off in PS 121. That was up the block from where I lived at. I switched from there and my parents had put me in private school. I went to St. Phillips and James until the 8th grade. Then I went to Cardinal Spellman High School.
All right. So,
you're wearing a uniform.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, slacks and like khaki pants and button ups.
Are we talking about like real strict teachers?
Not really, but they had rules like no facial hair. You know what I mean?
Well, you broke that rule.
Yeah. Now this is, I guess that's probably why I got a beard now, because I couldn't grow facial hair the whole.
To Cardinal Spellman right now.
Right.
Yeah.
It was like public school, except they just had a dress code. Like people behaved the same way. It was still the same type of terrorizing people in there that wanted to. You know, like every school you have, it's the yin and the yang theory.
Were you playing sports?
No, I was. I played baseball. Mm-hmm. Not in high school. I played like in outside leagues, but I didn't play for my school.
And what about the arts?
I was always good at drawing, so my that's how I ended up going to college for architecture. My high school guidance counselor was like, because, you know, I didn't know what I want to do. I said, what should I do? She was like, well, you're good at math, you're good at drawing, go do architecture. So I'm like, all right, cool. So I applied for the school of architecture in Howard, and I got through.
Did you visit Howard beforehand?
No.
So you went sight unseen?
Yeah. I didn't visit any colleges. No, I'm lying. I visited UPenn.
Whoa. UPenn. And also, you would have gone there for architecture?
No. Okay. I just went because it was a chance to get away from home and there was chicks there.
Yeah.
To be real with you. I never looked at college as something that I had to do or really wanted to do. I just knew it was a necessity in my household. Like, you know, you went to high school, you graduated, you're not staying here, you pick a college. And I didn't want to stay around my family in the Bronx, because I figured, you know, I wanted to get away and have some independence. So I chose Howard and luckily they accepted me.
So wait, did you apply to UPenn?
Did I? No. After I went there, I didn't apply. I applied to Howard, Hampton, and if I'm not mistaken, it was Morehouse.
Gotcha. So all HBCUs. You didn't end up going to UPenn, which would be all Jewish girls named Rachel.
And the crazy thing is, when I went to visit, the reason I didn't go, even though I thought this is gonna sound crazy, I hope none of the the black college is killing me for this, but the environment was better at UPenn. The reason I went to Howard was because a friend of mine was going there.
Really?
So I didn't want to go to college alone, you know what I mean? Like, have to meet brand new people and have no real friends. So at least one real friend was going, so I said, all right, cool, let me go to Howard.
And was that friend going to be your roommate? Or just like,
well, I thought so, but we didn't end up being roommates. We lived in the same building for the first year.
So you go down
and
there.
The crazy thing is we're not friends anymore, but yeah. It's crazy,
so
life.
So you go down there and...
So I said both of us just laughed at that. I don't know why.
No, but that's cool. You can't laugh about it. It's funny now.
Unless he listens to this podcast, then he's a great person.
And it's still funny.
But so you go down there. What is that environment like?
UPenn or Howard?
Howard. You're away from...
Yeah, fuck UPenn. You didn't go there.
No, Howard, the environment was like... Howard is real... I always said the only thing that messes up Howard is the classes.
Okay.
Because it's really like a place where if you do anything involving the arts, you're going to meet somebody as talented or more talented than you, almost guaranteed. So I liked it for that reason, as far as like whatever you did, there was somebody to keep you on your toes because they were probably better. You know what I mean? Like I said, I went to school with Young Guru. I went to school with Rich Harrison, and these are just people that were within 1 or 2 years of me. So imagine the amount of talent that went through there. You know what I mean? Like Diddy went there. Like we said, Tracy Lee went there. And this is during the height of Tracy Lee's career. This is during, you know, like Guru. Not saying this was the hype, but this, I think Howard molded all of us to become good entrepreneurs, as far as like, you know, and have just that, the rapport with other artists. You know what I mean? Like Howard taught us how to deal with other artists, mm-hmm. even though it was a school for, you're supposed to go for, you know, learning business,
right. Or architecture, whatever. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. But I ended up getting kicked out of Howard, by the way, but that's a whole nother story.
Right, but before we get that.
Yeah, before we get that. So yeah, I'm in school and I'm meeting all these people, but I don't know exactly what they're going to turn out to be. Like Guru was just a DJ. I was a DJ. He would DJ a lot of parties before I got there, obviously. When I got there, I started picking up the slack and doing a lot of parties. And it was just like, next thing I know, I'm running into Guru and Bassline with when I'm going to go work with Dipset. He's the engineer.
So how do you get those parties down at Howard? How do you like work your way in?
My first party I got from a dude that I knew that was a Q Dog at the time, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he was like, yo, we do this annual party every year, da 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 da. He said, are you nice? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, fuck, you gonna prove it tonight. You know what I'm saying? Like, kind of. So I'm like, all right, bet. And I never DJed a party out there before. You know, most of my, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that was the first real party I DJed.
Crazy.
But I lied to him and told him, like, yo, I'm nice, I can do da da da. And I went and tore it apart, man. And ever since then, I was, you know, they wanted me to do radio stuff, they different parties I was getting booked for. But I turned down the radio stuff because, stupid me, at the time I had a girlfriend who was like, yo, if you do the radio, we'll never see each other. Needless to say, I haven't spoken to her in over 15 years.
So you don't see each other?
No. Yeah. Right. But I didn't do the radio thing, which because of the thought of not seeing her, which now I look back, I was an idiot. And any kids that's listening, follow your heart, man. So
what was your specialty when you like really like ran
DJ?
A party? Yeah. Like what's that?
My arrangement, the way I did things was crazy because I used to set my sets up in a way that it was like there was like an hour of my parties where none of my records lasted more than 45 seconds.
That's what she
said. Yeah, I know, right? So I would set up the records in an order where I knew I'm going to play this after this after this after this. So people in the crowd, it was just an hour of people going berserk because they like, oh, I love this song. Oh, yeah, I love this song too. I love this. And so by the time that's over, they're drained. And now you can really just cruise through the rest of the night. So that was like my thing was like.
You were an aux cord DJ before there were aux cords.
Right, but except I was using a vinyl, man. Yeah. So it was like. My crates used to look crazy. Like, I would have records with no cases back to, because, you know, I was moving so fast, I didn't have time to find the case, put it back. It was just like, I don't know if you remember how DJs, like the coffins would look back
then.
Yeah. So I would have records just piled up in either side of the coffin until the end of the night, then I would just arrange it all back. But, you know, like, I miss those days a little bit, but it's different now.
You don't miss carrying them.
Hell no. Now you could never find somebody to help you at the end of the night. The beginning of the night, you had a bunch of friends. Like, let me help you carry it in. Once they get in and the night is over, you're by yourself. That's what I don't miss, but yeah.
So did you see DJing as your like as your career at that point? Were you like, fuck architecture, I'm just gonna stay DJing?
Then I don't wanna say I seen it as my life, but I seen it as a means to an end at that point. You know what I mean? It was like, I'm not gonna lie, around those times for a party I might have got about at most $400, mm-hmm. $350, $400, and so. But I was doing like 2 to 3 shows a week, so I might have ended up with like a stack by the end of the week.
Yeah.
But I always knew it was more for me to do. I just didn't know what I wanted to do yet. You know what I mean? Like my DJing thing, I knew that it kind of, I knew that's like, I loved it so much because one day I was doing a, I was DJing a, Grandmaster Flash birthday party. They flew me out to New York to do a Grandmaster Flash. They didn't fly me. They gave me money to drive. Yeah, I drove with them. And somehow I end up getting into an argument with Grandmaster Flash.
Happy birthday.
Like, you know what it was? They said, okay, cool. Because it was like five DJs that was supposed to DJ that day. It was like me and like four other DJs. And Grandmaster Flash wasn't supposed to DJ. It was his party. So when my set was coming up, the crowd was packed. Everything was going crazy. Grandmaster Flash goes, no, I'm getting on. And I'm like, yo, no disrespect, you know. Yeah. I came from D.C., man. Like, I didn't come here to just watch you DJ, man. Like, I'm going to do like 20 minutes and you could get on.
Yeah.
So he looked at his homeboy like, yo, who is this? Yo, I'm getting on. I said, yo, listen, man, unless you want me to turn this whole shit upside down, you're going to give me about 15 minutes. So now it's like an awkward stare down between me and Grandmaster Flash at his birthday party. People are looking at me like, yo, who are you to this? But you know what I mean? For me, it was like, no, I didn't come this far to just do this.
Yeah.
Like, I drove 4 hours. I'm not watching you DJ. Yo. And then this, like I said, this was the days of the crates.
Yeah.
I came down with 5 flight cases. There's no way I came down 5 flight cases to not DJ. It's impossible.
So you get on the turntables?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Was the first record you played The Message?
That would have been crazy, right? No, I think the crazy thing is, I think when I got on, I was so mad. I think I just emptied every good record there. Like, you know how for DJs, nobody wants to come after the guy that plays the number one records at the time. So I just played every record that was hot. I just played him back to back to back and Grandmaster Flash to the point where when I finished, he didn't DJ anymore because he was like, I'm not going to look like an idiot at my own party. Like, he played everything there is left to play.
I sort of want Grandmaster Flash to come on our podcast now.
Like, I don't even know if he would remember that. That's how, you know.
What, you don't think he remembers his worst birthday ever?
Yeah, I know, right? He might be like, yo, let me, I never knew that kid's name. Let me get his number.
Yo, that 5-hour drive back to D.C., you were smiling the whole way.
No, my homeboy that was with me was like, I think he was like a huge, because he set it up. He was a huge Grandmaster Flash fan, so he didn't speak to me for the whole ride back. Because he was like, yo, I can't believe, like, because I think he wanted a picture and all that. Around that time, you know, Flash was like, yo, you with him? No, there's no way I'm not. So he felt the way about it.
So how many years do you get through at Howard?
4. I was in a 5-year program. I got through four.
Architecture is 5 years, yep.
I got through 4 of it. I had 1 more year left to graduate.
And then Grandmaster Flash wrote a letter and got kicked out.
What happened was, I'm like I told you, I was in the School of Architecture. Mm-hmm. So I'm coming out the School of Architecture, and there's a girl that I knew. She's waiting outside. So me and her talking, but I noticed behind her, there's like 15 dudes across the street. So I'm like, I didn't think nothing of it. Because like I said, it's campus, but you never really seen that many people conjugate at one place. So I'm like, all right, cool. I walked off. Look behind me, same 15 dudes are following me. Now I have to give you the backstory to this, why this would happen, right? So I didn't even meet this chick. One day, I used to DJ out there, like I said. So every party I DJed at, I noticed that there's this one girl that's always there. Like, I don't know her, but she's standing by the turntable. She's always there. So one day, I'm on campus. I leave my building on campus, and I go to my car. By the time I get to my car, because I had drove up there and I went inside the building, but I left my car running. When I get back to my car, this girl is sitting in my car, right? So I get in the car, I'm like, yo, what's wrong with you? She was like, yeah, I'm coming with you. Keep in mind, I knew her from my parties, but I didn't know her. You know what I mean? I didn't know her name until that day. So she was like,
she's just in your car.
She knew it was my car. Yeah. You know what I mean? And she knew I, you know, whatever. So she's in the car. I'm parked.
Passenger seat.
Right.
She wasn't like sitting.
Yeah, like, passenger seat. So I said, I'm like, what's up with you? She was like, I'm coming with you. I said, yo, at this point, I had lived in Maryland, College Park. Mm-hmm. So I just came to campus to visit people I knew or whatever. So I said, I'm going back home. So I'm not driving back to campus. If you come with me, you're going to have to spend the night at my house.
Yeah.
She was like, I don't care. Long story short, she comes to the house. Whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
Days later, this is beeper times, right? So she's beeping me, paging me, calling me. I'm not hitting her back. I'm not, so whatever. So like I said, fast forward to me coming out the building, because now the story will make sense. So I'm coming down the hill, 15 dudes behind me. I'm like, I don't understand what's going on. So I really brush it off. I go into, like I said, I'm with this chick. So I go into one of the buildings is called the Towers at Howard at the time. So we go into the Towers. I stay there for about an hour and a half. When I come downstairs, see about 25 dudes. It's the same 15 dudes was the extra 10 dudes. So in my head, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I can't piece it together in my brain yet. So now one of the dudes comes and he was like, yo, you know this girl by the name of, I won't even say her name, right? Mm-hmm. So he's like, you know this girl such and such? I'm like, yeah, I know. What's up? he was like, yo, I need to holler at you for a minute. And, you know, if where I'm from, when somebody says that to you, it's automatic problems,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If I don't know you and you want to holler at me, okay. So once he said that, I said, yo, listen, keep in mind I'm in the lobby of the building. These dudes is outside. One dude came in to say that to me. So I'm like, yo, listen, man, I don't know you, so I don't even know what you want to talk about. I'm not with it. So at this point, I know it's a problem. I call my homeboy that's upstairs. I'm like, yo, listen, man, here's the situation. You can make your mind up if you want to. And this was my homeboy at the time. Like, he was real cool. The dude that I came to Howard with.
Yeah.
So I said, yo, there's a bunch of dudes downstairs. I think they got a problem with me. I said, it is what it is. If you want to come down, cool. If not, I get it, because it's like 25 of them.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, bet, I'm coming down. So while he coming down, Dick, keep in mind, it's still outside. I had like light jewelry on, a little bullshit chain and brand new leather I just bought, because I remember this day vividly.
Yeah.
So I take the chain off, take the jacket off, and I put it behind the security desk. And I'm like, yo, just watch this for me, because I know it's probably going to get crazy, right? So now my homeboy comes downstairs and my car is parked across the street in the parking lot. So I got to walk. If I want to get to my car, I got to walk through these dudes. So I'm walking through the, I walk through the door. Me and him, we walking through these dudes. They're not saying nothing. So they quiet at the time. They just like staring us down. So by the time we get past them, maybe about like 20 yards from my car, they're like, yo, hey, fuck you, you ain't shit, this, that, and the third, that, when I see you, then. So now we driving off. They banging on the back of the car. We drive off. So my plan was to drive off to get to my crib to get my cousin. My cousin was there. So I'm like, you know, come back with numbers.
Yeah.
We go home, tell my cousin, we get in the car. Everybody changes up. We come back. When we get there, instead of 25, it's probably down to like 15 now. So like 10 of them left, because we came back like an hour and a half later. They still there in front of the building. So now we hop out the car. My cousin walks up to the biggest dude and just hits him.
Yeah.
He hits the floor. The rest of them rush me. Right? So now they rush me. I'm on the floor now. They trying to stomp me out. I can still see marks on my hands from the shit. They stomp it. They trying to stomp me out. So now by the time I get up, I hit one of the dudes. Like a fight breaks. You know, a fight breaks out. My cousin's running around. I can't even say what he was doing at the time, but he was, you know, some people were getting kind of twisted at the time. And so we leave. We think it's over. We leave that day, go home. Next day, I come back to campus. The chick who started this whole thing, she's standing in front of one of the buildings with an empty Moet bottle in her hand. And at this time, and I was like, the way it went down, it was only three of us. It was me, my cousin, and my homeboy, and they had about, like I said, 15 people. The next day, I came back with, because I used to run with a bunch of DC dudes. The next day, I come back with like 10 DC dudes, like dudes that don't go to college, that their whole thing is to just get busy. I said, the chick is out there with a Moet bottle in her hand. So my homeboy walks up to him and was like, yo, you don't want to cause a problem. She tries to swing the Moet bottle and hit him. He grabs her wrist, takes the Moet bottle and hits her across the face and shatters her jaw.
Oh.
Right? So that's where my whole shit goes downhill from there, because nobody knows these DC dudes. They just know me. They're like, okay, we know DJ Arsonist, what they call me at the time. Like, we know Arsonist. So every party I'm going to, police are parked outside. Everywhere I'm, classes I'm going to, police are waiting there to question me, this, that, and the third. So I just came back to New York. Started, everything out there, you know, kind of worked itself out, because the chick ended up, like, telling people that she, what, you know, that she lied about a lot of things and this, that, and the third, and that she just wanted, she felt away because I wouldn't hit her back, and she lied to all these dudes to try to get them to get at me.
You wouldn't return her calls.
Right.
Yeah, basically.
I just deaded her. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I guess she felt used, like, because whatever happened between us happened and I never called her back.
Right.
And, so yeah, everything got straightened out, but me coming back to New York was like, that was like the worst moment of my life. Because I was out of school, had no plans. Parents didn't really know why I left school at the time. They just like, yo, he's home. What is he doing? And if not for that, I don't get into my music career. Because that's the only thing that forced me into producing at the time.
So you come back, and like you said, your parents don't understand.
And I had a baby on the way at the time.
So,
which makes it even crazier.
Yeah, wait. So
we weren't together, but my daughter's mother was at this time, what I'm telling you about, when I'm home for good now, she's about 4 months.
Oh my God.
So, and I have no income and
no degree.
Right. So you could picture, and at this time I'm 21. My daughter's born at 22, so 21.
So you sit down.
Right.
What are your options here?
And keep in mind, my parents didn't know I was about to have a kid. So I'm home, baby on the way, parents don't know, kicked out of college, they think I just wanted to leave. So I had nothing to fall back on. And my partner up the block, my man Thriller, he had just bought an MPC, and he was going out of town. I think he was going to Trinidad to visit his family or something. So I said, yo, let me hold an MPC and see if I can work with it. He lends it to me. I teach myself the basic things. I make like two beats, and those two beats ended up get me my first set of equipment because I ended up selling those two beats to Todd Terry. And Todd Terry asked me, you know, he wanted more beats. And I told him I couldn't make any more beats. I don't have any equipment. And he bought me like $20,000 worth of equipment and sent it to my crib after meeting him one time.
The legendary producer, Todd Terry,
right.
who does, he did I'll House You.
Mm-hmm. To the Batmobile.
He did the Everything But the Girl track, right?
He did everything.
I mean, yeah, he's just like, he's just legendary. Yeah. How do you meet him?
A friend of mine by the name of Rob Young. I don't know if you're familiar with Rob Young. Rob knows a bunch of people that I didn't think he would ever know. But he was working at Capitol Records at the time, and they had an office downtown on like 20-something street. So my homeboy from Brooklyn brings me to meet Rob because Rob was supposedly an A&R, but come to find out, he was like an A&R assistant who had like a, had like a little desk in the corner of the major room. You know
right,
what I'm saying?
Right, yeah, so, yeah.
We go meet him, but
he was the 15th guy,
right? But he, we go to his, we go to that office, and he's talking so much shit. You would think he was like the VP A&R over there. He's like, "Yo, listen, you got to do this, that, that." Anyway, he's like, "Yo, I'm going to my." He said, "I'm cool with this dude, Todd Terry, man. You should come to his house, man." He said, "You know, he's a, you know, Rob is the type that wants to big people up, not just on their accomplishments, but on the money and the possessions that they have." He's like, "Yo, he has a mansion in Jersey, he has Ferraris. Yeah, yo, you got to come to his house." So I'm like, "All right, fuck it, I wasn't doing it." And keep in mind, I go to his house, it's me, Rob, and Nicki Minaj.
What?
At this time, she's like 17. It was me, Rob, and Nicki Minaj go to his house for the first time.
Crazy.
Crazy. I just, now that we brought the story up, I just remembered that she was with us.
That's crazy.
That's crazy to me, now that I think about it. But yeah, it was
and
us three.
And she's Onika at this time. She's
yeah, Onika, like, yeah. Oh, yeah, Onika Mirage. Yeah.
So, all right, so you sit down with this NPC, mm-hmm. and you have... You know, obviously a musical background, but like, how do you get into programming something like that?
Just try. Like I said, the first two beats I made to me were trash. Todd is the only one that liked them. I thought the sequencing was not the sequence. I thought like my arrangement of the drums were bad. I thought my sample chops were bad. I just thought everything was bad. But he must have saw some potential in it. But like real arrangement and things like that, I don't really learn until about 3 years in. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I knew how to make beats, but to me, I didn't become a producer until about 3 years in. Because, mm-hmm. you know, production is everything you do after you make the beat.
Mm-hmm.
It's production. So I didn't really get... When I saw my first record to Cannabis, I didn't have a clue about production. Like, I remember I'm in the studio, and the engineer at the time was like, "Yo, I'm going to give you the wires, hook up to the MP, track this beat out." And I'm like, "What do you mean? I don't know. How do you track a beat out?" And at that time, you know, like, the engineer, I guess, you know, they had more free reign than now. He was like, "Look, I can't believe this shit. He doesn't know how to track a beat out. He's in the studio." And I'm like, "Jesus. Like, you would think, like his life was over because I didn't know how to track a beat out." But, again, I learned, and I rather things like that happen because I never wanted to feel like that again. So I went home and, you know, really learned my craft.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, so I was listening to the Juan Epstein interview that you did,
right.
and they play that song.
Yeah, the Cannabis
and,
song.
And Cannabis, like, his vocal is, like...
panned left and right.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So maybe imagine he's the one the studio. Who was fucked up.
Imagine in the studio yeah. that day trying to listen to that.
Yeah.
Do you know what that sounds like? Coming through big speakers and every one verse is panned to the left and the other verse is panned to the right, and you kind of like, "All right, what do I listen to?" But again, Cannabis was so hyped that everybody else in the studio was like, "Yo, that's fire," because Cannabis thought it was fire. So, and like, again, that was my first time in this, so I'm like, who am I to say shit?
Right.
I thought it was weird at the time because I'm like, I can't understand what's going on.
But maybe he was so future, like, you know, forward thinking, you were just like, "Oh, I don't, you know, who knows?" So from there, you end up in the studio with Big Pun and Fat Joe.
Big Pun and Fat Joe was actually the first thing. That's like, I'm a friend of mine went to school with Cuban Link.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, "Yo, I can get y'all in this." This when Cuban Link and Terror Squad and everybody, they was running. So he said, "I can get you in the studio with them. Just bring some beats." So we brought the beats.
Does everyone in the Bronx know each other? Like,
No. It's just, I mean, I believe there's less than 6 degrees of separation in the Bronx if you really search. You know what I mean? Like, if you're from the Bronx, you might not know Fat Joe, but I guarantee you know somebody that knows Joe or knows somebody that knows somebody that knows Joe. It's like
everybody knows Tony Sunshine.
Yeah, that's right.
So when I played a beat for Joe, he was like, "Yo, I like this beat. Can I have it?" I'm like, I say, "Yo, to be honest with you, such and such," I forgot who I said, what artist wanted at the time. I said, "Yo, this artist is interested in the beat." He was like, "Who?" And I told him the name. He was like, "No, I know who they are," but I'm like, "Who? You'd rather sell it to them than us?"
Wow.
And I'm like, because I didn't know how it worked. I'm like, "Yo, Joe, I don't want to offend you, you know, but da 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 da." And he was like, "Yo, listen, man, I like your beats, you know." I said, "How much do you make for beats?" Cause I didn't know at the time. I'm like, what do new producers get paid?" He was like, "Anywhere in the ballpark of like $5,000 they start off making." I said, "For one beat?" He was like, "Yeah." I was like, this is definitely what I want to do. Because I love music, and I'm like, I didn't know producers got paid out the gate $5,000 around those times.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's different because of the internet and all that, but I was with it.
So how do you establish relationships as a new producer?
I just think it's not being a dickhead. Because a lot of new producers will give a beat to somebody and they like it, then they'll charge them something astronomical, or they'll charge them, period. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was a new, like, don't get me wrong, because they were signed, I would have gotten paid, obviously, but that wasn't the first thing on my brain. The first thing on my brain was, I just want to hear their voice on my beat to build my resume. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of people, like, even dudes to this day hit me on Instagram. Like, I was on live the other day and a dude hits me, goes, yo, everybody out here want beats, but nobody want to pay. I'm like, how much you charging for beats? He was like, I don't know, man. If they give me like $500, I'll take it. I'm like, all right, so what are your accomplishments?
Mm-hmm.
What have you done to charge that $500?
Mm-hmm.
He was like, no, but I'm saying I put mad work in making these beats. And I'm like, all right, but let me put it to you like this. You should charge an independent artist about $500 for every plaque you got. He was like, but I don't got any plaques. I was like, exactly. Exactly. That's my point to you. You shouldn't be charging without accomplishments.
Yeah.
That's like you going to a burger joint that's in the middle of the street with no store. It's just like a spot. It has like a little table with a tent over it, and they're like, yo, these burgers are $15 a piece.
Yeah.
We're making it on this Foreman grill right here. You're like, why am I paying you $15 for this again? Like, you understand? Like, that's what it is to me. It's like, no matter how good that tastes, I am watching what you do. Like, I can do this myself.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like, when people buy a beat from me, I tell them all the time, not, I don't tell the people, but I tell other producers, when artists buy beats from me, 60 to 70% of what they're paying me for is for the name.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't get me wrong, I make great beats, but there's a producer out there that makes beats just as good as me. But the reason you're paying for mine is because mine is proven. You know what I mean? Like, awards came along with mine. Like, I've sold over 20 million records because of whatever the reason is, even if you want to call it a mistake.
Or the Illuminati.
Whatever it is, yeah. I've done it. You know what I mean?
So now you're getting established. Your name is getting around, seemingly, right?
Right.
How many beats are you making, like, a week? How many are you making a month?
At this point, you couldn't get me out the... I was making beats out of my mother's basement at this time. So I was making about... Realistically, I was making, like, 30 a week.
30 a week.
Yeah, and so I'd make like 5 a day. I would there's probably like one day I didn't make beats, so six, you know what I mean, like 6 days out the week I was making like 5 a day.
And what percentage of that are you like, yo,
selling?
Or do you think that like they bang?
I don't keep them if I don't think it bangs.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, when I tell you the way I used to work then was different. Like, now, because more business is involved, and because I have more responsibilities now as far as like overhead and things of that nature and other things I got to handle, I can't work at that pace anymore.
Right.
But back then, it was nonstop. I'm talking about from 9 o'clock in the morning until about, we're not talking about a short period of time during the day. I'm talking about from 9 in the morning until about 9 at night. I'm
yeah.
making 5.
Yeah.
Making and arranging. You know what I mean? So anybody that could tell you, the arranging is what takes the time. You got to mm-hmm. put it in Pro Tools, arrange it, break it down, EQ it, make sure it sounds good. But I was doing like 5 a day.
By the way, the way to keep down overhead is to just do it outside with a tent.
That's
over.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, no, right?
I guess the next person you meet is Renee.
Renee McLean.
Who is Cameron's manager at the time.
We went to go see him because we had artists that we wanted to get on the radio. And he was like, it's going to cost you this amount. And the amount he said was, it wasn't nothing. It was a nice amount.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we went to the car, got the money, came back, right? So now we got him looking like... What the, like, what do y'all do?
Right.
So, you know what we said? I said, yo, I'm a producer. It was like 3 of us. It was me, Thrill, and my other man at the time. I said, yo, I'm a producer. He was like, where are you a producer? I mean, he knew he didn't get money from producing me. He was like, yo, let me get some beats. I had this. I always kept the CD on me, so I gave him a CD.
How many beats on that CD, you think?
20.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked 9. That 9 made Diplomatic Immunity, and then I did an extra 2.
So, wait, what's going through your mind when he's just like, I'll take 9?
I didn't. Let me tell you how it happened. When I gave him the CD, we gave him the CD, and the artists that we went to bring to him were from North Carolina. So we gave him the CD.
Was it P.D. Pablo?
No, but it was around that time. It was definitely around that time. So we give him the CD. We leave. I go to North Carolina because I'm working with these artists. So while we're in North Carolina, Cam calls my man's phone. Because my man had given Renee his phone number. Like, yo. So Cam calls his phone.
Cam does.
Yeah.
So not Cam, British. Not right. Like, yeah.
So Cam calls and puts me on the phone. And I'm like, I say, yo, listen, man, whoever this is, stop playing with me. You know what I'm saying? He's like, no, yo, it's killer. I need you to come by the studio. We want a few of them tracks off the CD. And I'm like, I say, yo, this is Cam. He's like, yo, this is killer. Da, 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 da. I go back to New York the next day, go to Baseline. And the first record we did was I'm Ready, because I was on the CD. The first record we did, he tracked out I'm Ready, and they him, Juelz, and no, originally Cam wasn't on I'm Ready. It was right. just Jim and Juelz.
Oh my god!
And then Cam, that's why Cam is the last verse. He jumped on it later, but yeah, that was the first record we did. The next day after he called me, and then I was on the radio literally like 3 days after that, and we just kept rocking to the point where it was like, I don't know any producers that have had faster turnaround times and success than we did.
Okay, so wait, real quick. That's when you walk in and you see Guru.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Were you like,
yes.
What's up?
Yeah, it was crazy because it was like, Guru's like, he was like, yo, oh, what up? That I'll be chopping up for a minute. But keep in mind, it was years removed because Guru was 2 years ahead of me and Howard. So if I was mm-hmm. a sophomore, when I came in, he was already a junior when I was a freshman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he was gone before I had left. So he obviously he didn't know everything that happened and yeah. things of that nature. So when I seen him, it was just like, it was love. You know what I'm saying? It was definitely all love.
And how much of a beat did you have, like, actually on the CD? Was it just like you give him a little bit?
So, yeah, I give everybody so snippets, like about a minute and 10 seconds.
Yeah, and so they get a feel for it.
So you get a hook and a half of, you get a verse and a half of a hook.
And then you come in and you can, like, lay it out, arrange it.
Yeah,
the
just
whole
bring.
Thing.
Yeah, I just bring the actual session.
So, did you sit there while they recorded it?
They just looped up the 2-track and record. Yeah, I sat there and listened to it. But then, you know, they would have a day that you would come back in and bring the stems to, to track them out. But that day, he recorded straight over the 2-track.
This is your first time meeting all these guys?
Yes, which is crazy. First time I met Cam. I mean, I've met Cam at another place before, but I know he wouldn't remember that. Yeah. It was like at Jacob Javits Center for
the car show.
No, it wasn't the car show. It was something else, though. It was something of that nature. But I seen him, and I was just like, yo, Cam, I'm a big fan. This was like during 357.
Yeah, yeah.
And pull it. And I'm like, yo, Cam, I'm a big fan. He's like, yo, this was up, da-da-da. We just kept it moving, not knowing that a couple years later we would be working together. Because I did 2 tracks on Come Home With Me that somebody else tried to take credit for. That's a whole other story. But everything worked itself out.
Yeah, so Diplomatic Immunity, and they take nine of your tracks.
11 in total when it's all said and done, but 9 off of that CD.
Well, I mean, that has me mind blowing.
The crazy thing is that after when we were doing the track list, is Jim is doing the tracks. He's like, yo, who produced I'm Ready? He was like, yo, Heatmaker. He's like, yo, who produced More Than Music? He's like, Heatmaker. He's like, who produced Santana the Great? He's like, Heatmaker. He was like, yo, goddamn, you're gonna make more money off this album than me. So, yeah, that's when he figured it out.
That project obviously changed their lives. It changed your life, too.
Definitely.
So now you can go home. And you're a legitimate producer now. This is not like...
According to the masses, yes. You don't understand how fast... It goes from being in the studio, just recording what you perceive as random records, to an album being put in your hand, and you're like, oh, shit, like, this actually sounds good. I didn't... When I did records for them, I didn't do records with the hopes of the album sounding good. As stupid as that sounds, I just wanted to give them dope beats.
Yeah.
That's it. I didn't really understand the production side of making sure this record sounds good and putting a drop here. I just knew the beats had to knock. So I would just give them CD after CD. Like, to the point where they'd be like, yo, how the fuck are you giving us new beats every day? Like, how often do you make beats? Because like I told you, I make like 5 a day. Yeah. 5 that weren't throwaway beats. I made Dipset Anthem and More Than Music on the same day. Those are the last 2 beats to make the album. You know what I'm saying?
Those are the last 2?
Yeah. Because the other 9 were on that CD.
Right.
So whatever wasn't Dipset Anthem and More Than Music was on that CD.
That's
so
crazy.
Santana the Great. So what else is on that album? Damn, I can't remember the songs I did on that album. So whatever wasn't those 2, that was on the CD.
By the way, so now, you know, there's this whole conversation. There's like 44,000 signatures of people who are like, I
55.
Want... 55. 55?
And they deaded it at 55.
But they want Dipset Anthem to be the national anthem.
Which would be great.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, your publishing would be very happy. But actually, I wonder if they would take it away from you.
Oh, and let it be like a public thing?
Yeah, if it's public domain, then.
Oh, we should really like think about this.
Yeah, guy. Like let's talk out your business right now.
No, but they would have to at least buy it out, right?
Oh, mm-hmm. True.
They would have to. Like they would have to cut me a check for like, okay, this is gonna be the national anthem. We'll give you $20 million.
Yeah, I like how it's like the proverbial they. Yeah, like whoever this they is.
Right. Will have to right. Because I don't know who exactly is gonna cough the money up. But can you imagine that at like a basketball game or just like a boxing event? It's the Juelz and Cam coming out, stood alone on my 4 corner. If he would just stand their hand on their heart.
I mean, I would not kneel.
No, so, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to kneel. Like,
who was in the room? Was Duke the God in the room? Was like
During which point?
When you got in baseline for them to record I'm Ready.
Let me see. I'll lie. You know what I remember about that conversation? I don't even know if it's... And Cam will probably laugh about it now because he probably don't remember. I just remember Cam being on the phone with, I don't know who it was at the time. It might have been some chick he was talking to at the time. This is years ago, so I don't want to, I ain't trying to stir. No, this is like 2001 or 2000, something like that.
There have been a few situations since then.
So. Right. Yeah. So he was on the phone with some chick or something. I just remember him saying like, yo, it's a privilege for you to fuck with me. You should be proud that you fuck with me. You understand? Like, you should be happy I'm on the phone with you right now. You heard? And I just remember standing there like, yeah, fuck with him, man. Like, anybody that's confident, and he was just sitting back, feet up, chilling, smoking a blunt. I'm like, yeah, fuck with him, man.
Did you see any of those beats going to like anybody in particular before you brought it to that camp?
Nah, never. I just like I said, I just
you made, just knew they weren't my going beats to Fat Joe.
Well, if I'd have seen him, I'd have probably. I just didn't see Joe around that time. Yeah. But the beats that I was making were so signature that I couldn't hear a lot of artists. So I didn't even know how they rhymed to "I'm Ready." Because if you listen to "I'm Ready," it's the swing of that beat is weird. Any rapper will tell you, like, if you're not really good at coming up with flows, you can't mess with that beat. Mm-hmm. The same thing with a lot of the other music we made, like I Love You, Purple Haze, things of that nature. You know what I'm saying? It was hard to find people to rap on that, and they just, it was perfect for them.
Yeah.
So it was like a marriage made in heaven.
Shout out to Renee, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're big, definitely. I haven't seen Renee since. Mm. Yes, definitely.
In terms of like your entire like Dipset library, are there any samples that would not clear?
Yeah, a bunch, and they were the ones that you wouldn't expect. Like Maxwell wouldn't clear a sample. I had a record with Jewels, and who was on the hook? I forgot who was on the hook, but it was called Daddy's Home. It was a Maxwell sample, and he wouldn't clear it. And then I had an R. Kelly sample. You remember How I Feel? This record called How I Feel. Mm-hmm. I think it was Hell Rel and Killer Cam, and Kelly wouldn't clear it out, I don't think. Then I had a record with it was supposed to be Jewel's first single at the time. It was Jewel's and Ashanti.
Whoa.
And it was a Bobby Womack sample, and he wouldn't clear it. Man. So yeah, I've lost about 8 records to sample clearances. But in the grand scheme of things, I've put out hundreds.
Yeah.
The eight that were lost were either people didn't want to pay to clear it, or like when we did because, you know, when you sample stuff and you're going for clearance, you have to send the owners the song so they can study the song and see whether or not there's any lyrics they don't like.
Yep.
So the original I Love You sample was Isaac Hayes. So when we had the original sample, and keep in mind, in that song, Jewel's is like, I'm a young Omar Atta, da-da-da-da-da. So, and then the tag they chose to put on the beat, the tag was like, because, you know, they put a tag on there so people don't steal the song and play it early.
Yeah.
So the tag was every 10 seconds. It's Dipset, bitch. It's Dipset, bitch, throughout the whole song. So then we get the sample thing back. They're like, yo, Isaac Hayes ain't clearing. And I'm like, I wonder why. Yo, is it because of you mentioned Omar Atta in the Towers? You had Dipset, bitch, going through there every 5 seconds.
Do you remember when they signed to Rockefeller, they went up to Angie Martinez, and they were just like, yeah, we're the Taliban. And yeah, I'm just yeah, like, yeah, this yeah, is yeah, not yeah, a good yeah, idea. Yeah.
Like, no, and especially the time of the, you know, like, Dipset diplomats were diplomats before 9/11, but after 9/11, certain things that was going on became like they. I think they broke down one of Jewel's records. I forgot one record. It might have been the "I Love You" record, and they was like on the news. They was like, rapper Jewel Santana calls himself a young Omar Atta, da 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 da. And I'm like, oh, man, they really blow. Because you got to mind around this time, we were all kids.
Yeah.
When I say kids, I don't mean like, you know, like too young to drink and shit. I just mean like we were kids. We were just doing adult things as far as like making adult money, moving around like adults. We were 24, 23. Jewel's was probably like 20, 21. You know what I mean? So it was.
He was living the crazy life.
Yeah. Keep in mind, all of us kind of were like, you don't expect to get. My first check from off the diplomatic community was over 100 grand. Then I did Jewel's album when I did 12 records. So that was over 100 grand too. Then I did a publishing deal for $250,000. You know what I mean? Like, so it was, you couldn't tell me nothing around those times. Like, I was making more money than my parents.
Hey guys, we just want to take 1 second to interrupt this podcast to remind you that on November 2nd in Los Angeles, California at the Bootleg Theater, we are going to be performing live. You can go support your boys, It's The Real, by going to itsthereal.com and buying your ticket today.
We're going to be doing comedy. We are two funny motherfuckers. We're going to be on stage doing comedy. We will also have our music to perform. We will do some stories. And yes, there will be special guests.
Wait, Jeff, did we just confirm one special guest last night?
We sure did.
Did we confirm another special guest today?
We sure did.
Do we have another one that we're about to confirm?
an actual third special guest?
Yeah, well, Jeff, you tell me.
Yes.
Okay, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And also, guys, we're not done. We're working on more special guests. We really hope that you'll be there. And if you're not able to come, we hope you buy a ticket anyway. Again, buy the ticket, forward the PDF to eric@itsthereal.com and jeff@itsthereal.com. Let's sell Los Angeles out.
So that we can show up at your house and perform directly for you.
And now back to the podcast. How much did you consider yourself part of the Diplomats, or did they consider you like their in-house producer?
I think it worked both ways. We were like family in a way. You know what I mean? Like the way, like even to this day, my relationship with Jim is like a longtime friend of me. Yeah, we've done music together, but Jim is genuinely a friend. You know what I mean? Like even if I wasn't talking about music with him, I could talk to him and it, you know, like I'm not around Cam as much as I am around Jim or Joel's, but I'm not around Cam or Joel as much as I'm around Jim. Mm-hmm. So it's different, but we were always like close-knit in the sense of they needed something they could call me and vice versa, and it was always love. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Regardless of where we were at in our career. And it's still all love. People don't see us working together, but it's still all love.
But you know what I mean? And no one can dispute this. Your sound was the sound of the Diplomats.
Right. So I've heard.
What was your relationship like with other producers around Bassline, like Just Blaze or Kanye or anybody else who came through?
It was cool, but I guess it was that quiet competition where it was like I just remember one day. I mean, Just probably don't remember this, but I remember this shit like it was yesterday. I was in the studio. I was, you know, I don't know if you've been to Bassline before, yeah, but it was open. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You remember Bassline had the little B room to the left. They had the A room to the right when you came to the eye. So I was in the B room playing beats for, this is early. This is before Jim ever even had a solo project. I'm playing beats for Jim. And Just Blaze is on the boards because he was using the room at the time. But, you know, I guess Jim asked him if I could play some beats for him. So I'm playing beats for him. And when I'm playing beats for him, Jay walks in. So Jay walks in and one of the beats, Jay's like, yo, I like this. And Jay's rocking from side to side. And Just Blaze is like, yo, listen to this, Jay. Cut that shit off and put his own shit on. Jay was like, yeah, that's cool. And walked out the room. And in my head, I'm like, this is what it is. This is the type of business I'm involved with. You know what I mean? Like, it's survival of the fit. Mm-hmm. That's really what this is. Even in what you guys do, it's survival of the fit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you're not willing to make that extra move, somebody else is going to. It's like if I didn't stand up for myself and be like, nah, Jay, I did that. Yo, just did that play. Then he has all right to be like, yo, Jay, nah, cut this off. Listen to this. People are only going to let you do as much as you let them do. So, you know, again, it was a learning experience. I was young. I didn't want to ruffle anybody's feathers at the time, so I kind of stayed quiet. But I always wondered what if, like, if I'd have just been like, nah, that's me. You know, that I got this and that, and I did X, Y, and Z. So you never know.
We did this Rockefeller thing at Highline Ballroom.
Right.
And
which looked dope, by the way.
Yeah, it was awesome. And Just and Guru and everyone did give you guys big praise for everything that you created. And
man, I think everybody, like, to be honest with you, like I tell the story about Just, it's no hard feelings. It's just like one of them things that you just learn for next time. It's like mm-hmm. you can't really be the quiet church mouse in the corner of the room and expect to get things accomplished. And I learned that day.
They also said that, like, every week there was, you know, another Diplomats record going to K-Slay and out on the radio. And
like I told you, my work ethic and their work ethic, it was like they had to fight for studio time. That's why if they said it that day, but they stopped recording in Bassline because it was almost like a situation where there was tension there, because Cam and Jim and Joel's would be recording, and then let's just say they want to record and Bleak and GDK was in there. Then it's who has the authority to take this room over? You know, like Jay was the top one. If Jay said something or Jay did anything, nobody's gonna fight with Jay for studio time. But other than Jay, it was like a rat race.
Yeah.
Whoever got there, whoever thugged the other person out the most to take the room back. So it was like after a minute you just started seeing, because like we recorded 90% of Joel's album at Sony. And 10% was at Bassline. Diplomatic Immunity was like 100% at Bassline.
Mm-hmm.
Until when Joel's album started, we kind of had to, we moved because, like, again, it was just too much testosterone around, man. Too many guys fighting for the same spot. And it was like, I think Cam felt like people were trying to steal his wave. So he didn't want to record around, you know, the usual people. So that's my assumption.
Yeah, but, yeah, yeah, yeah.
who knows? This is, we're talking about 16 years ago, 17 yeah. years ago.
Did you think at that time that you were only going to produce for Dipset? Or were you like, I want to start looking outside of that? Or
no, I wanted to, but I didn't want to be disrespectful about it. Because there was a point in time where another group of artists had asked me for some music. And then Cam and Jim got wind of it. And they called me like in a frenzy. Like, yo, they trying to steal our waves. Yo, don't, this is our wave. Don't, you don't got to give them no beats. This is our shit. Da, 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 da. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to argue with Cam and Jim because they put me in the position I was in. So I was never going to, you know, like go against what they were saying. So I was like, all right, cool, bet. And I never gave that artist beats. And then they ran into me one day and was like, yo, damn, you only fuck with Dipset, huh? You ain't fucking with us. And, you know, I was just like, I said, nah, but that's my family. They got first, you know, they got first right of refusals, everything I'm making right now. So, you know, it's no hard feelings. And I never ended up doing work with that, with those group of artists. But, you know,
so,
who knows?
So, Jewel's relationship with Def Jam sort of had its peaks and valleys.
Right.
How did that affect your guys' output?
I think during that time was kind of like, because ever since we did Diplomatic Immunity, from what I remember, you know what I'm saying? I could be wrong, but from what I remember, I don't remember having another session where it was all three of them in there. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody necessarily had problems. I just think it's like the group where every member has his own fan base. You know what I mean? Like, Jim had the right to feel how he felt. Cam had the right to feel like, and Jewel, because they all were separate stars on their own. Jewel's went platinum mm-hmm. with his second album. Cam is Cam. And Jim had Ballin, which did his numbers. So it's like, how can you tell anybody to do anything if you're... So it was like, when everything started separating, it was just, it happened without... Nobody really knew. It was just like, one day you in the studio with Jim, Cam, and Jewels. Next thing you know, you're in the studio with just Jim and Jewels. Then you're in the studio with just Cam and Jewels. Then you're in the studio with just Jewels. And you know, so you don't really pay attention because it's happening in front of your face. So you don't really know. You know, it's just like, oh, Cam is doing something today. Or Jim doing something today. But then before you know it, it's just like, nah, it was just, this just how it is. You know what I mean? It's just they're not around each other no more. I don't know. It was weird.
Were you going to be involved in the Wayne and Jewels project?
Yeah, I had two records on there.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you still have them?
I've never heard them.
Oh.
I just know that Jewels did it. He told me he did it. I just never, like, that, you know, that fell apart kind of, mm-hmm. kind of on the fast side, man. Because at the end of the day, it's like, what I think, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like Wayne's progression as an artist has a lot to do with Dipset, even down to fashion. You know what I'm saying? And that's not knocking Wayne. That's just what I saw. I just remember Wayne's clothes being extra big before he met Dipset. Then it's starting to get fitted. Then the Louis sweaters came out and the belts, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like skulls and stuff. So, and then, like, but he was calling himself Dipset South too, right?
Was he?
I think so. I'm even making that up.
I don't know if he was. I don't know. Yeah. The crazy thing is, my man British is the reason I got on Wayne's album. Because British and Baby were cool, and British was like, yo, I'm do some work with Wayne. He said, give me some beats to give to Wayne. So I give him beats in March. Wayne hits me back in October. He's like, yo, you send me the files to this and that. And then I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, yo, I'm using these on my album, but we only got 24 hours for mix. I need you to send it now. And around those times, I remember I was in the Bronx, and my homeboy was like, I said, yo, I got to send it now. He said, yo, come to my mother's crib, because you can send it from there. Because, you know, I needed internet service. Mm-hmm. Why did his mother have dial-up? It took 5 hours to send about 9 sounds. Anyway, it got done.
Yeah, yeah.
Needless to say.
And then you got two records on there, right?
Yeah, I did The Mob and I did Receipt.
Which are incredible songs.
Thank you.
I do want to talk about, you had one of the very, very early Gucci Mane placements.
Damn shorty. Yeah, he did that in my mother's basement. I was in the basement.
So I was up in the Bronx.
Yeah.
You had Gucci up in the Bronx.
Yeah, Gucci. Amazing. And Gucci and his two his two henchmen. Yeah, one dude guarded the door and another dude guarded the steps that led upstairs to my mother's.
Because there's a lot of trouble going on.
Right, so I said to him, I said, yo, you do know that. And keep in mind, these dudes didn't say a word. Like, they just, the whole time, they just quiet. So Gucci's like, nah, don't worry about it, man. They good. Just, I'm like, yo, I said, my mother's up there. Like, nothing's going to happen. He's like, nah, they feel better like this.
Wait, so, yeah, so you knew Gucci early and you knew Nicki early. Like,
but did I didn't, the thing is, I met Gucci through a dude that owned a record label by the name of Fat Cat Records. It's this dude named Fat Cat. He was cool with my homeboy at the time, and he was like, yo, I got an artist named Gucci, da da da, we need some beats. My man was like, yo, my people's are producers. And I didn't, you know, like, again, if I would have known the type of music that Gucci made, I'd have probably been like, nah, he's not gonna like none of my stuff. But then he came, I played him some shit, and he picked like one of the first things he heard.
So what was early Gucci like?
Like now.
Yeah, same.
Gucci came, because we had a store in the Bronx at the time, like the soul, sneakers, clothes, things of that nature. He came in there and just bought like, probably like about five to ten pairs of Air Force Ones at once, like, and then I remember he was going to Atlantic. He was like, "Yo, unless they give me a million, I'm not signing." And in my head, I'm like, "I can give you a million." So he came back like, "Yeah, they tried to offer me like 600,000-700,000. Man, fuck them." I said, "Yo, you turned 600,000 down?" Because at this time, I didn't know the hype behind Gucci. Because yeah. I was, you know, I'm from New York, so. Yeah. When I spoke to my man in Atlanta, he's like, "Yo, you just did a record with Gucci?" He said, "Come on." He said, "Yo, Gucci the shit down there, man." I'm like, okay. So that's when I started to realize the mystique of Gucci.
A real quick aside is that recently Joe Budden on Everyday Struggle said that he gives credit to Dipset for enabling the South to sort of like grow beyond just the South.
Of course. What I'm saying now is going to seem blasphemous. But understand what I'm saying and really think about it. We help create trap music. Now, when I say that, think about the records that I made and think about the bounce. Think about Postman. Take out the kicks and snares on Postman. It's a trap song. Wait a minute, Mr. I mean, not even the snares. Let's take out the kicks and put 808s. Mm. Wait a minute, Mr. It's a trap song. The bounce was a trap song. A lot of the Dipset records were, I made a lot of my beats slower. But I use crazy hi-hats to make them feel like they were moving faster than what they were. So that's what's going on now. The same crazy hi-hats. Because I remember Timbaland used to have his hi-hats a certain way. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to do it like that. That's too fast. So I would put my shit on like a 16th and a third for all the producers. They would know what that means. But it's like, it's a different swing. You know what I mean? And it gave a different type of bounce. And producers do it to this day. They switch it up, but they do that. They, you know, like if you listen to the hi-hats, a lot of that is reminiscent of the stuff that I did in 2000. So it's not far-fetched to say that Dipset helped enable the South.
Yeah,
because the beats they were on were similar to trap music.
Did you ever produce anything for Cat Williams?
No. I never even met Cat Williams.
Really?
I thought when he had Dipset chain, that was just like Cam, a marketing tool for Cam. I didn't think he was really signing Dipset, but I guess, you know, you guys just validated.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that?
I don't know. Still signed to Dipset? I think everybody's still signed to Dipset. Is Dipskate still a thing for you?
Is Dipsex still around?
Yeah.
That's a better question. Yeah. You know what's crazy? You ever met Big Joe? Big Joe. One time, this is when I was trying to do the rapping thing for a minute, right? So I go to Big Joe. I'm like, he's like, "Yo, I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do for you, Austin, because you're my man. I got the, you know, Cam just gave me the rights to this Dipsex. The next scene that we shoot, I'm gonna have you in the back just rapping while this dude is banging this chick out." I'm like, "So, Joe, man, no disrespect. I don't really see my career going in that direction, man." So I'm
thanks, Joe.
Right. I mean, I appreciate the gesture, but me rapping behind a dude giving back shots to a chick is really not what I envisioned my career, you know.
But that being said, you know, you went to school for architecture.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You don't know how to build your career off.
Right. Right. It's not why I want to be remembered when this is said and done.
Yeah.
Like, pull up Dipsex Volume 7. He's on that. Nah, I'm all right.
Killing it.
Oh, my God.
All right. So we can all agree that you have a signature sound at this point.
Right.
So that brings us to, you worked with Beyonce.
Right. I didn't work side to side with her, but I did a record for it.
But the song is so not like you.
Right, because I'm going to tell you what happened. It never got finished. What happened was I had a, when I, the first studio I ever had around the time when I met Dipset was on 57th and, might have been 57th and Broadway. It was right underneath a Hard Rock Cafe. I don't know if they moved it now, but this was like, we're talking about 2001. So, or 2001. So,
talk about overhead.
Well, you know.
Right. Now, no, but around that time.
After 9/11, everything changed.
Yeah, no, but I'll tell you, around that time, we had some money. Just around the time, we had a Rename It Clean, gave him the thing. So, a friend of mine that, not even a friend, but he managed, this dude had managed Bruce Springsteen. One of the dude that owned the floor that we rented. Mm-hmm. He had managed Bruce Springsteen. So, do you remember, I forgot this guy's, the guy that, I think he played in The Sopranos. He was on Bruce Springsteen's guitar player.
Oh yeah, sure. Stevie.
Right, Stevie was in the studio. So Stevie goes, "Yo, I like what you guys are doing." He said, "Yo, let me play some. He grabs a guitar, he starts playing a bunch of things. And I don't think twice about it. He's just playing things. So now I got it. And one day I'm like, "Yo, let me listen to it." I go back to my computer and I find these guitar riffs. And I'm like, this is dope. So I chop it up and I arrange it in a way that sounds, you know. And I just remember I had it on a CD because I couldn't think about what type of drums I wanted to put to it. So I just had the chops and the arrangement on a CD. And I go to Sony to, this is right after we did our publishing deal. Was it right after or right before? Might have been right after. Anyway, I bring that CD to Sony and I'm playing them different things and I forgot that that's on there. And the chick was like, yo, go back to that. I said, yo, it's not finished yet. She was like, nah, I want to hear that. So she was like, yo, I got to give this to Solange. Solange could write a dope record to this. And I'm like, yo, but let me finish. She's like, nah, trust me, acoustic is better. Just leave it like this. So Solange writes the record and the record was supposed to be for Joss Stone.
Okay.
Right. So then Joss Stone hears the record, but Beyonce referenced it. Solange wrote it, Beyonce referenced it. Mm-hmm. So Joss Stone hears the record and was like, yo, I can't sing it like this. So I'm not even going to waste my time doing the record if I can't pull it off like how she sang it. So instead of letting the record go to waste, because it was a, you know, the record was a dope record, written dope. They liked everything. So they was like, all right, cool. Beyonce will keep it. So I'm hyped. I'm like, all right, bet Beyonce gonna keep it. She gonna change my life.
Yeah.
So now, when this record is popping, Matthew Knowles is her manager at the time, her father. So he's like, yo, you know, I like what you're doing. Can we, I want to sign you guys. Let's work something out. So I go see him. He's like, yo, all right, here's what we're going to do. I got a, you know, 5-year situation. I get 30%. And that record you just did for my daughter, he takes out a piece of paper and he writes on the paper a percentage. And he said, this is what you're going to be left with. And I look at the percentage. I'm like, don't get me wrong. I understand you got to pay to play the game sometimes, but I'm like, nah, this don't feel right. I can't. I was like, but this is an original beat. Mm-hmm. Why would I take this? He said, nah, you know what? My daughter wrote it. My other daughter sang it. My other daughter that sang it, she keeps the lights on in Sony. So this is what it is. And I'm like,
what a gangster.
I'm like, nah, I don't think I could do that. He was like, yo, listen, just think about it. I said, be honest with you, man, I don't really feel comfortable doing that because I know I'm getting robbed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks, the Bronx way.
2 weeks later, right. Yeah. 2 weeks later, the record gets leaked.
Oh my God.
And they say they ended up putting it on like a bonus album overseas. Like, you know, they just didn't put it on any album over here, which kind of twisted me up. But I know why it happened. You know what I mean? I'm not. Records from big artists like that, they don't just get leaked.
Right.
Yeah.
You understand? Like, if there was a single out there right now with Beyonce and Bruno Mars, it's not going to get leaked.
Right.
You understand? So yeah, to me, records that get leaked or got leaked, if they're from huge artists, it was planned like that.
And that song was called what? Stop Sign?
Stop Sign. Yeah.
Where do you go after that point?
After that point, I go to Vegas. I get a little residency to DJ in Vegas.
Well, and
because my music thing slowed down. People weren't buying my type of music anymore. You know what I mean? They were buying, this was like the Little John era, and this is when Krunk was turning into Trap.
Right.
The last record that I was about to place that, Jim probably doesn't even know that he cost me this. Jim and Jewels had did this record called Rider Music, mm-hmm. right? But yeah, it was just a beat that they had on the CD that I did. I didn't know they did it. That record was supposed to be Jeezy's first single.
What?
Jeezy hears the record and was like, yo, your boy Jim is on. I can't do nothing with this. He put it out already. So I lost Jeezy's first single on his first album because of Jim.
Oh my God.
But I don't even think Jim knows that to this day.
Wait, what happened going back? Ghostface put out a song.
Ice.
Yeah.
And then Cam, it was Come Home With Me.
Yeah.
Same
beat.
Exactly. Yeah. Same beat. What you hear Ghostface rapping on was straight off the CD. He didn't mix it. No, that was what, like, it was a minute and 1 second. No, it was 59 seconds on the CD.
Yeah.
It was a minute and 1 second on his album.
Yeah, we called it an interlude.
Right. Because he. So when I approached Ghostface people, obviously, because on the original one, it says produced by Ghostface, if you ever read that. So when my lawyer had reached out to them and they changed the production, they didn't even put heat makers like they were supposed to. They just put arsonists. But I ended up getting paid for that. And, you know, and then when Cam got it, I told Cam, I said, yo, you know, Ghostface had taken this beat off the CD and put on his album. He's like, I don't give a fuck. Just give it to me. He's like, I like this shit too much. So Cam paid for it again. And I got more publishing off of that. And
it's legendary.
Calling me. I don't understand. It's probably just an emergency while we're sitting here. But go ahead.
It's a legendary way to start that album, and it's just like, yeah, you make your way down to Vegas.
Right.
And
I was DJing at Rehab. You ever heard of Rehab?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was DJing Rehab.
So what's life like down there? Like, that's
insane.
Yeah.
It's almost unreal to the point where you have to leave to know reality.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Because I got caught up in Vegas to the point where it's like, because keep in mind, Vegas, you can walk the strip with open liquor. You can have a weapon on you as long as you have a card, like, because they have two cards out there. One card you can have, I don't know if it's still the same, but this is like 2008, 2009, around that time. And one card allows you to have your weapon concealed. The other card, you have to have your weapon out so somebody can see it. So, mm-hmm. you know, if some, but to me, that's crazy in itself. Right. That's like, yeah. it, like, when, like, I'm in the car with my homeboy that's from Vegas, and we're driving around, and police pull us over. So police, you know, first question is like, yo, you got any weapons in the car? I'm used to that. I'm in New York. They asked that. You like, nah, I don't got no weapons in the car. He was like, yeah, I got on. He pulls out. He pulls down, like, his arm. He had this thing in the back seat. He pulled it down. He had, like, a long ass, like, some crazy shit that you shouldn't even have in your car.
Yeah.
So now my heart is in my stomach, like, oh, it's over for us. Yeah. I'm going to get locked up in Vegas. I'm never going to see New York again. Like, it's over. There was, like, even the police officer was like, God damn, what you need that big ass gun for? But the way the police reacted, I'm like, he didn't seem bothered. So then he was like, nah, look, I got my car. He showed him his card. He was like, all right, man. He said, yo, but listen, calm down, man. You ain't fucking Rambo. You don't need them. But it was just bugged out to me. I've never been in a car where police ask you if you have a gun in the car, and you say yes, show it to them, and they're cool. I'm not, it never happened ever, like, in life. Man. So when I saw that, I'm like, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
But again, Vegas is a different place, man.
I mean, now they're going to change it, I'm
sure. Yeah,
sure.
Oh, yeah. It's over. Yeah. It's over.
Because, like, I was reading a thing where they said that of all the places in the United States that are, like, that were not ready for a terrorist attack, like, Las Vegas was, like, one of them.
The reason being, Vegas switches out people every day.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, if you live in Vegas, you, the odds of you running across the same person twice on the strip, rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They swap out people every day. They're from different parts of the world. When I was in Vegas, like, about 2 months.
Yeah.
Meet new people every day.
How do you stay away from, like, gambling or...
I had a problem with gambling.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Super problem.
Yeah.
Did you go to rehab?
Yeah. Yeah, but... No, it was bad. It was to the point where, like, I was out there getting money produced for somebody. And let's just say one day I would go in the studio, whatever, and let's just say they would give me, like, $5,000. I would lose that before I got back to my room. Like, it was bad. It was bad. It was to the point where I had two bank accounts, and I would have to leave one bank card in New York to stop me from getting to the money. Like, one day I remember I'm in Vegas and I invited a chick out to come chill with me. And by the time the chick gets to me, because I get to Vegas first, she was from like LA, you know, and I told her meet me in Vegas. And by the time she met me in Vegas, which was like 18 hours after I got there, my money was done.
Damn.
Like, to the point she wanted to get something to eat. I'm like, we gotta go to this vending machine.
Yeah.
Did you ever work with who's the dude out there who gave, like, French Montana the monkey?
Oh, Molly Mall.
Mall, yeah.
Yeah, I was recording out of his studio.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, me and Molly Mall was chopping it up for the... It's bugged out.
That place is supposed to be crazy.
His studio?
Yeah.
Official.
Yeah.
Official. Keep in mind, his studio's in the back of his house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the day that I'm leaving Vegas, like, I'm going back to New York, you know, I'm in the studio, so I'm like, all right. He said, yo, before you leave, come in the house and come check me and, you know, stay later. I'm like, all right. I get in his crib. I don't know if he still got it.
Mm-hmm.
He had a hot tub in the middle of his living room. So now he's sitting in the hot tub in the middle of his living room with his chef cooking dinner in the kitchen. I'm like, it's okay, man. He's a good dude, man. He's a good dude. But, like, when I was going to his house, his shit is crazy, man.
Yeah.
Even back then, I'm you know, you're pulling up to his house, so you're going up, like, this driveway. You see Phantom. You see tour buses. Like, crazy. Crazy.
So you come back to New York.
Yeah.
Is New York ready for you?
Are you ready for New York?
Yeah, that's the question. Because, see, that, like, when I came back to New York, the residency I was supposed to do in Vegas, I was doing it for a couple weeks, but right before I signed the contract, and the contract was going to be a nice number.
Yeah.
They was going to fly me back and forth to New York once a week, put me up in the Hard Rock. I was going to have my own suite in the Hard Rock for 6 months, and the money was nice. When I tell you nice, we're talking about nice six figures. Nice, right?
Hot tub in the middle of your kitchen, nice. Right. Yeah.
The dude that set it up fucked the whole deal up.
Damn.
He was just a money hungry dude and fucked the whole deal up, man. And I ended up coming back to New York to face reality. So that was around the time, like I said, music had changed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm back in New York. My money, my income stream, as far as, like, the Vegas thing, which was a great gig, you know what I'm saying, was by the wayside now because of this creep. So now I'm back in New York with no plan. And kind of, to be honest with you, kind of, like, defeated. You know what I mean? So this is 2010, around this time, 2010, 2011, you know, going around those times. And I just had to kind of go back to what made me love music. It wasn't, you know, like, before the money, before cars and jewelry and things of that nature. It was like I went back to my mother's basement and I just set up equipment. And I just worked for like a year. I didn't try to sell beats. I didn't do nothing. I didn't even know who I was going to sell beats to. I just kind of shut everything down and made music.
But even if you were selling beats at that point, I don't know that you could make money. Because, like, 2010...
It was
like,
weird.
That's the time when, like, the internet is, like, a total war zone, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
Every... Producers were not getting paid. Right. Because, like, if your song comes out, it's just, like, on the internet.
Right.
Like,
and keep in mind, Apple and, like, iTunes and Apple Music and all those things, around those times, still didn't really figure out how to work with the labels, you know, like, cohesively. It was kind of like a fight. Mm-hmm. The labels were like, we're not getting our money from the internet. They were still trying to push physical copies when it was evident that physical copies weren't relevant anymore.
Yeah.
So it was that weird time in music where music was changing and people didn't know how to monetize it anymore.
Yeah. Right. Like, there were no streaming services, none of that.
So if you were an engineer that got $2,000 for a mix, that was done. If you was a producer that was getting $20,000 for a beat, that was done. Because now everything is accessible. It's like, why should I pay this guy $20,000 for a beat when there's millions of beats online that I can download for free? So it was weird for everybody involved. I think over the last 3 years, 4 years is where everything really, now we understand how streaming works. We understand how to really monetize off of YouTube. And you know what I'm saying? Before, it was a lot of gray area. Like, you put something up on YouTube, you get 1 million views, so what? And then back then, they couldn't really gauge what was real and fake as far as views go. Now, they have a system in place where it's like, okay, cool. We know if this is fake, we strip the numbers and suspend the account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back then, they couldn't do that. You would see the random dude with 3 million views. But it was just for the look back then, because people used their YouTube views then to get deals. Now, if you're smart, use your YouTube deals your YouTube numbers to get yourself a distribution deal
or a residency over at rehab.
Right.
Yeah.
So damn. At that time, when you're like, let me go back and like get into that zone and feel like I did when I was hungry.
Right.
How is your sound changing at that point? Because, you know, certainly like that Dipset era is on the decline at that point. And you're the face of that. Do you switch it up? Do you decide like, I'm going to ride this out? Like, where's your head?
Here's the thing. I never tried to make a sound. So when it's hard to switch something that you didn't try to do, it's like if somebody says, yo, yeah, your walk is kind of played out, man. Switch your walk. You're going to be like, yo, I've been walking like this since I was a baby. Like, I don't try to walk like this. I just walk like this.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's like making fun of somebody's laugh. And
right.
Like
Eddie Murphy. Right. Yeah.
Right. It's like you don't think about it. It just becomes your thing. Like, if people just make certain things your thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they made that sound our sound. So it was kind of like it was a gift and a curse. Because when it was dying down, people were like, even to this day, and people don't understand that this pisses me off when they do this, but I don't know if I should take it as an insult, but like if I'm playing beats, somebody be like, oh yeah, that's that 2001 feel, that's that. And I'm like, what does that really mean?
Right.
You know what
They're
I mean?
Talking like, about Millennium.
Right, but I never understood that. It's like, so you're going to tell me 10 years from now, if Metro Boomin plays a beat, they're going to be like, oh yeah, that's that 2015 feel. You're like, no, you just either you like it or you don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when I listen to music, I don't, certain things give you a feel of an era. But ultimately, do I like it or not? That's all it boils down to. It doesn't boil down to, yeah, I would like it, but it's not like some 80s shit. Mm-hmm. I can't really like it because that's not what's in. What do you like? To me, that's been the biggest problem with music, is that people put it in a category of, this sounds like some boom bap shit. I don't know. Or this is some this. And to me, it's just music. It's like, do you like it or you don't?
At what point do you relocate back to Manhattan?
At this time, like I said, I'm not really making a ton of money. I'm still getting my publishing, things of that nature, whatever the case is. And one day I get a call from a dude. He's like, yo, I got my homeboy here. He's a big Heatmaker fan. He's from out of town. He wants to buy some beats. And I'm pissed off with the music industry, but I'm like, all right, fuck it. He said, yo, come down to Quad. He's gonna be down at Quad. So I go down there and I bring a CD with like 20 beats on there. It's a magical number. I put 20 beats on, no, a flash drive, because by the time the CDs are gone. It's like 2000 and this is the beginning of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I bring a flash drive. I play him a bunch of beats. And when it was over, he said, yo, man, I want 10 of them. I said, do you know how much I charge? He's like, how much you charge, man? I said, at this time, I'm like, you're an independent artist, man. Give me like $5,000 a beat. I didn't really give a fuck. I was so frustrated. It's kind of like I wished he would have said no, because it would have just given me more reason to be angry and make, you know what I mean? So he was like, damn, man, I don't want to insult you, man, but I only got $25,000 on me now. Can I give you $25,000 now, $25,000 in the morning? I'm like, I said, you serious? He was like, he pulled out $25,000, gave it to me, said, yo, man, I don't want to insult you, man. I'll call you first thing in the morning with the other $25,000. Keep in mind, he doesn't have none of the sessions to the beats. He only has them on CD. So the next morning, he wakes me up. Like, yo, can you meet me at the bank in Harlem and da-da-da-da-da? And that money that I got around that time, one of my homeboys from L, well, he wasn't my homeboy at the time, but he was a friend of a friend. And he was like, yo, you know, I just got my hands on some money. I'm trying to invest in some shit. I know you fuck with the music. And I'm like, yo, I got my hands on a little bit of money too. Maybe we could put something together. And there's the birth of Diamond District Studios. Mm. And we've been rocking ever since.
And who was the guy who bought your beats?
This guy out of North Carolina. South of North Carolina. South Carolina. His name was CB Smooth.
Talk about some of the people who have come through Diamond District.
All the Dipset members have been there. Fat Joe, Remy, they record there regularly. Panda was recorded there.
Yeah, Designer.
Designer's been there. Famous Dex has been there before he was famous. Jermaine Dupri has been there. Tech N9ne has been there. Ty Dolla $ign has been there. Life Jennings has been there. Anybody you could... It's been so... ASAP Ferg has been there. ASAP 12e has been there.
You produced for ASAP 12e.
Kodak Black has been there. I'm missing a lot of names, but a bunch of people. If I look, Raekwon has been there. I'm thinking about the people I've taken pictures with on the gram.
Yeah,
Raekwon has been there. Spragga Benz has been there. Yeah. Wayne E1 has been there. Just a bunch of people, man. Like, I'm missing a lot of names, but everybody that except with the exceptions of like 50 Cent and Eminem and Jay-Z. But you know, all the other artists that's on the middle level. They've been through there.
So around this time, 2013, I think.
Right.
Kanye reaches out to you?
Khaled, for Kanye.
Khaled reaches out to
which
you.
Which is an interesting conversation, because at the time I was in Canada. So Khaled calls me. This is like 2 in the morning. I'm asleep, so the first voice I hear is, yo, this Heatmakers, what's up? I say, yeah, what's up, who this? Yo, it's the DJ Khaled. Yo, Kanye want me to reach out to you because he need that sound. He need that hit. You got it? And I'm like, I said, yeah, I got it, man. I said, yo, send me an email. I'll send it to you in the morning. Yo, you don't sound excited. What's up? You got a chance to get on Kanye's album. He personally asked me to reach out to you. What's up? I'm like, yo, Kanye, I'm super excited, man. I said, I'm just tired. He said, all right, send the beats in the morning. And I send the beats in the morning. So then after they pick a beat, Khaled calls me to kind of get all the information so we get it squared away with the lawyer. So he's like, yo, when I pick up the phone, he's like, congratulations, you just made the Yeezus album. What's up? I'm like, yo, that's what's up, man. He said, yo, you don't sound excited. What's up? I said, nah, I'm excited, Khaled. He said, nah, you don't understand. Yo, congratulations. I'm like, nah, I said, yo, that's what's up, man. Like, if anybody knows me, this is as excited as I get.
Yeah.
I don't really, even if I'm excited, you won't see it. I'm just like, okay, that's what's up. Let's go. And he couldn't, I guess he couldn't, in his head it was like, nah, I gotta I gotta feel that he's excited.
Yeah.
So needless to say, those were our two encounters over over the phone.
So you sent the beat. Did you ever hear anything from that?
No, never did. That's the crazy part. I never did. Like, and I don't know, man. Kanye's a different dude, man. He's a different dude.
Did you have any interactions with him, like, through Baseline at all?
Yeah, definitely.
What was he like back then?
Well, from what I know, he was like almost the same type of dude, but just, I guess, with less pull, so he couldn't be as crazy or as, what do you say, eccentric?
Yep.
Like, I remember, I just remember it was a situation with a chick. It was some chick that I was trying to talk to at the time, and I think Kanye was trying to talk to the same chick. So, but I don't think she wanted, this is before Kanye had popped. I don't think she wanted to talk to Kanye. So one day we in the club together and I'm at an event where I had just got an artist signed and we were having like a, we were celebrating. So the chick was there. She was like, it was a club. She was dancing in the cage at the club, right? So I see her and she's like, yo, you got to stay next to me. Just like, Kanye's on me and I told him that you my man. I don't want him around me like that. So then Kanye comes over and I'm talking to her and he just looked pissed off and just walked off and never spoke to me since that day. Like, I don't know. It was just weird. It was weird. Like, we had and I don't know if he even knows about it, but it was a couple situations dealing with chicks that, you know, whether I was trying to talk to and he was dealing with or vice versa, and it was just weird. But.
And that's why your song didn't end up on music.
I probably did that just to tease me, like, yo, tell him send me beats. Tell him I like this. Throw it in trash.
And then you had a placement on Fat Joe and Remy's album.
Too Quick. That came about, I was playing beats in the studio for an artist by the name of Lights Cameras. He's from Brooklyn. From Philly. His name is Lights Cameras, and I was playing beats for him, and I played this one particular beat, and he started humming a melody. When he started humming a melody, Joe walked in. Joe was like, "Yo, what's that? What's that?" He's like, "Yo, I like that. Record that." So he goes in the booth and lays on a reference track, Burning for Joe, and Joe gets his man to put words to it. And there it is.
Does Joe remember your first interaction all the way back?
We've never spoke about it, but we've known each other for so long. Like, I've known Joe since 99. That's when I met Joe. It was 1999. So just shit, it's almost 20 years since I've known Joe.
But now
he's been the same person ever since.
And now he's good enough for your beats, so.
Yeah, I know, right?
In fact, Joe can get a beat now, which is better than Grandmaster Flash, who could have gotten a beat down.
A beat down, there it is. Arsonist, thank you so much for coming through. This was dope.
Yeah, let me think. I don't think about it. Like, even when I was telling the story, I said that Nikki was there.
Yeah.
It's just bugged up. I don't think about things in retrospect like that. I just kind of, as people ask me or I do things like this, I bring it up, and then it'll come back to me like, oh, she was there. That's crazy. I'm still waiting to get in contact with her. Nick, if you listen to this interview, stop playing games, man. Heatmakers, you know what it is already, man. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you guys for having me, man. Lovely place.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's our Manhattan mansion.
That's right.
Beautiful.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of Waste Time with It's The Real. Jeff, if people want to find out more about us, we're It's The Real. If people want to find out more about this podcast, it's called Waste Time with It's The Real. And people want to find out more about our headlining show out there in Los Angeles, our first time performing in L.A. on the West Coast, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com. Get your tickets today. You can also always listen to all of our old episodes at soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. We are also available streaming on iTunes. Search for A Waste of Time with It's The Real, ITSTHERAL, all one word, no apostrophes, no spaces. We are also on Spotify and all streaming services if you want to listen to our music. Teddy Bear Fresh is the movement. Go listen to our album, Teddy Bear Fresh. You can also find it on soundcloud.com/itsthereal. If you want to find us on social media, we are on Twitter at It's The Real, Facebook at It's The Real, Instagram at It's The Real, also on Snapchat at It's The Real. But, you know.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, Jeff, we're just collecting followers at this point.
I'd like to make mention a couple of our songs. Sugar High is now officially up to 364,000 plays.
Ow.
Our song Girl Your Ass Is Like a Metaphor is officially at 210,000 plays.
Ow.
Guys, go to Spotify and support your boys. It's The Real. Jeff, you know, and we've talked about this a lot, this podcast isn't going to grow unless you guys tell a friend, and that's the goal. Let's have our whole audience tell their friend, and let's double up. Like Mace, let's double up. Jeff, who do you want to shout out to spread the word?
I have so many people to shout out today.
Here we go.
I don't want anyone to feel they're not special.
Right.
Because each and every one of them is a star in my eyes.
Let's go.
Okay. I want to shout out Mike from Albuquerque.
Yeah.
I want to shout out Ray from Long Island.
Yeah.
I want to shout out at 6'5" on Twitter.
All right.
Napalot Records. I want to shout out Balls Got Weight.
Hey.
I want to shout out Anna Says.
All right.
Niles by Nature.
Let's go.
Smooth G.
Hey.
Excuse me. _ Smooth G.
Well,
fuck Smooth G, whoever took that with the without the underscore.
That's what I'm saying.
I want to shout out Robert Glenn. Mm-hmm. I want to shout out Charlotte Not The Main.
That's right.
I want to shout out Teflon Don at DJ _ Don BDMV.
Man.
I want to shout out Leo EPD. I want to shout out Sheeta. I want to shout out NC_ Queens.
Let's go.
Yo Boy, the coolest. And of course, Lens _ Anderson out in LA. Quit playing, brothers. Drop that shit about this episode.
Well, we just dropped it. Guys, thank you for saying that you wanted to hear this episode. Also, I believe there were one or two of those people who were just like, no, hold off. Well, sorry about that, guys. I, Jeff, would like to shout out our friend Jenna Luckman, who bought a ticket, even though she may or may not be in the building. I want to shout out Justin Aguiar for buying a ticket, even though he will not be in the building. I want to shout out Dynamite, even though he will not be in the building. And I want to shout out Shale, because he will not be in the building, but he bought a ticket as well, and there's more people. But guys, as they come in, hopefully we will be able to shout you guys out on future episodes. Maybe we'll drop a couple next week. Who knows? Here's the thing. We appreciate you guys for appreciating us. This is something we do out of the love for the art, a love for the craft, and at the end of the day, a love for you guys. Thank you so much for supporting It's The Real. Not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week. Bye.